This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today I have the pleasure of talking to Margaret Talbot. She's the author of a book called The Entertainer: Movies, Magic, and My Father's 20th Century. Margaret's a writer for The New Yorker, and her father had an amazing life, I think spanning most of the 20th century. So how are you, Margaret?
I'm fine. How are you, David?
Good. Well, I'm really glad to talk to you. Your book was published in 2012 in hardcover. It's now coming out in paperback in November of 2013. And maybe you could talk. You know, your father was a. His career spanned an incredible array of what we would call show business, starting when he was a young man in Nebraska, going out on the road, kind of basically in circus and vaudeville. People may wonder, but he was born in 1902. You're obviously much younger. You were the youngest of the children of his final marriage.
That's right.
How
I was a baby, and he was 60 when I was born. So he was an older dad for sure. He was born in 1902. So, and I'm 52. So, if you sort of do the math, that makes sense. And of course, my mother was quite a bit younger, 26 years younger to be exact. So that's how that worked out.
Right, and so he had four children, including you. But this was sort of his settling down period, would you say?
Well, that's right, yeah. I mean, in fact, you know, one of the things people sometimes ask me, you know, this is a book that is, you know, about your father. You sort of researched it as though you were researching a book about somebody that you didn't know in some ways. I mean, because I did try and approach it as a reporter, and there were certain things that I did not know about my father's past at all. My parents actually had a very strong marriage, but it was kind of predicated on their not really talking about my father's fairly extensive, amorous past. And so I knew, for example, that he had been married before, and my siblings knew this too, but we did not know how many times. And when I did the research for this book, I discovered that my mother was actually his fifth wife, which we were all somewhat taken aback by. The previous marriages were kind of brief Hollywood marriages to some interesting women, but women who, in the end, I must say I'm quite glad were not my mother. They were kind of, some of them were sort of Hollywood starlet kind of party girls who I think would not have made the most, would not have been the most moms. And I actually ended up with a wonderful mom who had some party girl instincts, but was a really loving and decent person. And my father late in life made this very, very happy marriage. And that's part of what the book is about, is this kind of love story of my parents. That's an element of it.
Would you say that, I mean, this is maybe asking you to be self kind of analytical, but would you say that the impulse to write about your father's early life is in part because he was older and there's this sort of feeling that kids have, they want to know who their parents are, so that even though you are a writer and a reporter, the impulse was more personal than professional, is that fair to say?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, I think, you know, when you have an older father, and of course, I think in a way, older fathers are probably becoming more common in our time. But there is this sense that they, I think there's a sense with all parents that, you know, kids may initially be sort of slightly put off by the idea that their parents have this past that kind of excludes them and might seem kind of remote and alien or fascinating, but maybe a little too much, you know, to sort of grapple with when you're a kid and you kind of want your parent to just be your parent. But when the parent is much older, like mine was, and I would sort of come across these pictures from 1930s movies, or once I remember when I was a teenager, I found this picture in the garage of this very beautiful blonde woman sort of cupping her breasts, and, you know, written on it was, I'm holding my own till you get home, darling. And so this was, you know, I showed it to my mother, and she sort of said, oh, yes, I'm not sure what that is. So, you know, there was a curiosity, but the curiosity was kind of dormant for me for a while. I was always interested in my dad's stories, actually particularly about his childhood, which was also very remote and sort of Willa Cather territory. He grew up in a tiny town in Nebraska called Brainerd, and it was mostly Czech immigrants, who were called Bohemians then, around the turn of the century, who lived there. And so it was very much like, you know, My Antonia, or one of those Willa Cather novels. And so I was kind of fascinated by that. I mean, he remembered when electricity came to this town, for instance. And so to have a father who, you know, had that kind of connection to the historical past became very interesting to me as a child. But then later, yeah, I got very interested, and in some ways it was easier. I wrote this book after my father had died. He died in 1996, and he was 92. And, you know, I was able to delve into some of these aspects of his past with a little bit more freedom, I think, than I would have when he was alive, by which I mean, you know, some of the relationships and so on, which he didn't necessarily want to be forthcoming about when he was married to my mother and, you know, at various other points in his life.
Well, but of course, anybody growing up with a father or mother or grandmother or grandfather who had been, you know, an actor, I mean, there's something very exotic about that, you know, for anybody. So did you find, I mean, when you were growing up, he was still working as an actor. So you grew up as the child of a, you know, someone in show business, basically.
Right.
So, I found it through my own experience, because I've, you know, had similar family involvement in Hollywood. And it demystifies it to a certain extent. I think a lot of people romanticize everything about Hollywood and theater and television, you know, which is one of the reasons why people still go into the business there. You know, it's romanticized to some extent. Did you find, as the child of an actor, that it wasn't so romantic to you, or because all of that history that he had was so long ago and kind of mysterious, that it was actually romantic and interesting to you in a different way?
Yes, I would say more of the latter, but a little bit of both. Because, you know, when I was growing up, for example, I grew up in a town called Studio City, which was actually named after the original Max Sennett studios that were started there and then became the home of CBS television studios for a while. And it's in the San Fernando Valley. And our neighborhood was this kind of neighborhood of people who worked, you know, in the business or in the industry, as we would call it, but they weren't, you know, sort of the stars. It was like a neighborhood of sort of stuntmen and, you know, TV script writers and kind of, you know, workaday Hollywood. I mean, the people who make the industry go, but not necessarily, you know, the most glamorous. We had down the street from us the guy who was the voice of Tony the Tiger. Earl Ravenscroft was his name, and we were always his kids trying to get him to do the voice, and he never would, sadly. But it was that kind of person, people who did voiceover. It was a guy who wrote scripts for Get Smart who lived across the street from us. So it seems like a kind of, you know, this was where people went to work every morning. And my father was on Aussie and Harriet for many years, and my brother was on Leave It to Beaver for many years, so as a kid actor. So, you know, they would kind of go off to work in the morning to, you know, their respective TV sets and studios, and that was, you know, that was just work, right? But I think my father also was a great storyteller, and he would tell a lot of stories about his early days and sort of, you know, the golden age of Hollywood in the 30s, and, you know, about being in movies with Carol Lombard and Humphrey Bogart, and you know, of course, those were glamorous. And honestly, I mean, I think there is a real glamour. I don't think it is all sort of, you know, mystification. I mean, of course, there's a lot of that. But, you know, when I look back on the life he led, it was pretty amazing. You know, he was a guy who came from this little town in Nebraska, you know, from a really kind of humble background. And, you know, because he was a good looking guy and he could sort of hold his own on stage, he eventually ended up, you know, living this kind of amazing life in early 30s Hollywood, you know, spending time at Hearst Castle and, you know, being out on the town at the Coconut Grove every night with, you know, a different starlet on his arm and you know, making movie after movie after movie, because that was the era where they were just, you know, pumping them out of the studios. His studio was Warner Brothers. So, you know, and also he talked about Hollywood having this kind of small town feel, which was sort of fascinating to me too. In the early 30s, you sort of forget what a big deal air travel was. There wasn't really commercial air travel to speak of on a large scale in the early 30s. And so, you know, to go back east, you'd have to take a train. So he really felt like it, you know, they used to call Hollywood the colony, the movie colony. And I think he really felt that way, that it was this kind of self-contained world almost. And I remember he went on this famous train trip organized by Warner Brothers, where they sent some of their stars, it was called the 42nd Street Special, and they sent it back for the inauguration of Roosevelt, because they were big supporters of Roosevelt, the Warner Brothers. And so Betty Davis was on, and Tom Mix and his horse were both on the train, and a number of, you know, chorus girls. And, you know, he was leaving Hollywood for the first time since he'd arrived, and this would have been in 1933, and he was just amazed at the crowds who came out to greet the trains every place they stopped, because it was sort of the first time he realized, I think, what a big deal movies were, how they were, you know, sort of colonizing people's imaginations and the pull of that glamour. And in his time in Hollywood, in this sort of cozy version of Hollywood he was living, where, you know, Hollywood Boulevard was like mainstream, you'd run into people you knew, and Greta Garbo going into the tailor to get her suit made and so on, you know, he just had no idea in a way of the impact of movies in those early years of the Depression.
Well, that's an interesting facet of his life. And actually, it is really amazing that his coming to Hollywood story is almost out of the movies. You know, it's sort of kind of classic, you know, unexpectedly making good essentially when he was about 30. You know, it's just
incredible. You know, yeah, I can tell that story. An excerpt from the book ran in the New Yorker, and it was called The Screen Test, and it told this story. But it's my father was, I mean, it is sort of a classic, and he was an actor who was working in the theater, and he was doing a play in Dallas at the time, and theater company went belly up, the owner absconded, didn't pay any of the actors, and it happens in the movies and it happened in real life, so he was stranded. But luckily, he was about 30, and a talent scout had seen him. It was that era when they were the studios were feeling that maybe many of the silent era actors weren't going to successfully make it into talkies, and they would have to start trawling sort of the theaters across the country, regional theaters as well as Broadway, to bring some talent out. And my father was identified by a scout who, just at that moment, you know, just in the nick of time, sent him a telegram saying, come out for a screen test. And my father had to say, I'd love to, but I don't have the money for the train ticket. And the scout working with an agent named Arthur Landau, who's a very lovely, courtly older man who was also Gene Harlow's agent, sent him the money for the train ticket. So he arrived in Hollywood and was meant to do the screen test, and had a play that he had been doing in Dallas with great success, which was a very kind of a front page, sort of very frenetic, lots of ringing telephones and, you know, barking kind of orders in the office, kind of a fast-paced play called Louder Please, which was actually set in a movie studio. And he'd had success doing this role in during this play in Dallas, so he decided to do his screen test as a scene from this play, Louder Please. And he did it, and when it was over, the cameraman who was shooting the screen test came over and said, was that from the play Louder Please? And my dad, feeling very proud that he had recognized it, said, why, yes, it was. And he said, you know, that play is completely taboo around here, because the play was actually about Daryl Zanuck, who was the head of production at Warner Brothers at the time, and it was a very insulting play about Daryl Zanuck, and it had been written by a former publicity man at the studio who, you know, did not like Zanuck, and it was a, you know, satirical representation of him. So, you know, my father was devastated, had no idea. He was very naive in many ways, and called the agent, and the agent said, oh, gosh, well, maybe we can get you a, you know, a role in another studio, a screen test in another studio, but really was thinking that this was it for my dad, this, you know, rube who'd come out, you know, so wet behind the ears that he'd done this play that was, you know, an insulting play about Zanuck at Zanuck Studio. In the end, what happened is Zanuck came in and was watching the screen tests of that week or that day with the director, William Wellman, who was this very kind of irascible, rebellious spirit, and thought that my dad had done this on purpose, you know, to snub his nose, to thumb his nose at authority, and was so admiring that he said, you got to hire this guy. And Zanuck, for whatever reason, in the mood he was that day, said, okay, sure. And Wellman said, I want him for my next picture. And he was in, his first picture was directed by William Wellman, and Wellman would never believe that my father had not done this on purpose, was always coming up to him and saying, you really showed that son of a bitch. And my father would say, you know, believe me, I never would have done that on purpose. My dad was actually a very kind of sweet and, you know, kind of obedient guy. In many ways, he would not have done that. But he earned his, you know, his stripes and his admiration from Wellman that way.
That's a great story, actually.
Yeah.
Well, did you find, I guess the other thing I wanted to ask you about, besides, you know, your sort of personal interest in these things, you know, your father worked in Hollywood for years, was in lots of movies. He was kind of an almost star. You know, he was a leading man and a character actor. And as you say, he acted with some of the most famous, especially leading ladies of all time, as well as a lot of the most famous male actors. But, you know, I think one thing that you talked about in the book that I thought was interesting was his involvement in the Screen Actors Guild, which essentially was a union in the 1930s. You know, that was the period of unionization in all kinds of American business. And, you know, Hollywood was really run like a feudal system. So having a union for any, or having a bunch of unions, was a pretty, you know, it was not unexpected in those times. But as with any other industry, those who organize the union sometimes pay a price for that. And I think the suspicion you have is that that harmed, you know, the fact that he wasn't a superstar. So, like, Ronald Reagan was involved in the Screen Actors Guild, but that didn't, he was a big enough star that they couldn't really derail his career. But maybe for your father, because he wasn't, you know, like really the superstar kind of level of actor, being involved in the Screen Actors Guild may have hurt his career.
Yeah, I think it probably did. I mean, he also was one of the founders. So I think, you know, Reagan came in a little later, by which time, you know, the guild was pretty much accepted, not happily necessarily by the studio executives, but accepted. And so I think, yeah, he was, you know, kind of a young leading man when he was one of the original, I think it's 30 or so founders of the guild. And so he was kind of going out on a limb. Many of the other actors who were involved in it were older character actors at that time. A number of them were British. They were people who'd come from the theater and kind of had other lives. So, you know, he, I think, was taking a risk. And it seems funny to think of it now in a way, but, you know, the studios took this very seriously. They had spies who would go around to the meetings of the actors. They would harass them. They would really, really try to discourage it. The Writers Guild was forming at the same time, so they sort of had two fronts they were dealing with. You know, they wanted to maintain the kind of control over actors that they had, which meant being able to, you know, work them as hard as they wanted for as many hours as they wanted and assign them to any film that they wanted them to be in, with the actors having no say. And so, you know, they didn't want to accommodate to the unions, and so they, you know, they took it pretty seriously. The studios did. And yeah, it was an interesting period, because the unions in Hollywood also were being threatened, not only by the studios who didn't want them at all, but by the mob that was trying to take them over. I mean, there's some fascinating stories about sort of Chicago mobsters who came out to Hollywood and essentially kind of tried to take over the unions, and you know, some of them had some success, but in the case of the Screen Actors Guild, the person who stood up to them was this very urbane actor, Robert Montgomery, who, you know, always played the guy with the cocktail shaker in his hand, and it was a, you know, a Republican actually, and but he was very very pro union, and a lot of those guys really had a feeling of solidarity with sort of all of the actors, you know, up and down the hierarchy, so the extras and those guys, as well as the contract actors and the bigger stars.
So, which period of your father's life is kind of the most interesting to you? I mean, you could break them into really distinct periods. There's the pre-Hollywood, the Hollywood, maybe the war years a little bit, and then there's the later television, well, theater and television acting period, which is the one you grew up in more. But if you think about his life and as you tell his story, which period kind of attracts you the most?
That's a good question. I guess I would say two. I mean, one is I got very fascinated by this period in the teens when he was a teenager and in his 20s and started out in these, as you were mentioning earlier, these kind of traveling tent shows and carnivals and magic shows and vaudeville, but vaudeville that was in sort of the Midwest, you know, traveling throughout these small towns. And I don't know, that era, sort of the, 1916 to 1928, let's say, kind of fascinated me, in the sense that it's this, you know, it's before there's really mass entertainment. Of course, there are movies, but many of the small towns don't have movie theaters yet, and people are still very dependent for their entertainment and their excitement and their news of the outside world on, you know, these theater troupes that are coming into town in that sort of, you know, romantic way where they sort of shake up the town a little bit and, you know, probably attract some starstruck kids. And, you know, my father had a lot of stories about that, including stories about, you know, it was an era still when actors were also thought to be quite disreputable. So, you know, they would go into towns where there were hotels and boarding houses that wouldn't take actors at all, or they would have rules where they could eat in the dining room of the boarding house, but they had to hang up a curtain in between the actors and the sort of decent, you know, folk who were staying there. So, you know, and yet people had this very intimate relationship because they got to know the actors would stay for several weeks at a time sometimes, and sometimes, you know, like a circus, they would set up a tent outside of town to perform during the summers. And so kind of the relationship between the townspeople and the visiting actors, that really fascinated me. So, and that's a fairly remote world for us. I mean, we don't really know, you know, we don't know a lot about that world. And so he, you know, and he had left some wonderful scrapbooks that really chronicle that time with these little, you know, little tiny town newspapers, you know, Bone Steel, Nebraska, and places like that, you know, writing about the tornado that knocked the tent over, and then, you know, what happened the next day, and the, you know, and the girls from the town who ran off with the theater troupe. And so I got very interested in that and loved, you know, going through those clippings. So I would say that era, and then, of course, the early 30s in Hollywood, and I got very interested in the pre-code era of films, you know, which was basically up till 1934 in the early 30s, when the Hays Code, which was, you know, the morals code that really determined what could be shown in movies for many years until we brought the ratings system in to replace that in the mid-60s. But there was a period of time in the early 30s when, many people will probably know about this, but where the code was not being enforced very stringently. So you got movies that were just a little racier, a little more cynical, and which broached subjects like drug addiction or homosexuality or, you know, various themes that were not, that were supposed to be verboten according to the code, and that, in fact, when the code was enforced, did not really come up in movies for quite a long time. And many of my father's early films were from that era, and I hadn't really had a chance to see them much growing up because they weren't really shown on TV even then, even in the 60s and 70s when I was growing up. Now they've really been rediscovered by TCM, and there have been, you know, a lot of pre-code film festivals and so on, and I've been able to see some of my dad's, you know, early work. But I got very interested in that and the possibilities of those films, what could be shown and what could be discussed.
Yeah, no, it's. I think both of the periods that you just mentioned are really interesting. I think definitely the teens and 20s, it's a period of amazing transition. And as you say, it's kind of the end of 19th century style entertainment and communication over, with the beginning of the 20th century style overlaid on top of it.
Exactly.
So it's a really, you know, any period of change, I think, is really interesting. And of course, you know, today we live in a much more, you know, changes everywhere. It's affecting everything. But I think then, in the context of that period, it was very similar.
Exactly. And just the self-consciousness about it is really interesting to see, like the fact that people are talking about what young people are learning from watching movies, you know, and, for example, learning, you know, how to kiss and how to be sexy or alluring and how to, you know, behave on a date. And, you know, there's sort of a frankness about and an unself-consciousness when people of that era are interviewed, and there were these studies that were done to kind of determine, you know, how much movies were corrupting youth, basically. And, you know, they have some really interesting interviews with young people who just talk about how, you know, and you just have a sense of how kind of overwhelming and seductive movies were, and it gives you a very fresh sense of it if you're reading the contemporary writing about it and studies of it.
Was it more difficult for you to do research in that period just because it's, you know, there are fewer first-person accounts, I would think, that you'd be able to reference, and unlike studying a filmic period or a television period, you can't see, I mean, the stuff that, this is always interesting to me too, that as you talked about all the live events, who knows what they were like, you know, there's,
right,
we can't see them. Now, of course, when we see movies of the 20s, they're all black and white, and it makes us think the whole world was black and white, but I, you know, the, just a kind of, it's so hard to get a sense of what it was actually like to go to a small town circus or a vaudeville performance. We just don't have a point of reference because we've never seen them.
I know, it's so frustrating to me. I would love, as I'm sure many people would, you included, probably, just, you know, just for a day, right, to, like, you know, be able to time travel and, you know, go to one of these little towns in, you know, 1917 and go to this circus or this hypnotism show or whatever. But, you know, barring that, which unfortunately doesn't look like it's in the offing anytime soon, you know, I do think it's, I mean, I got a lot out of reading small town newspapers, and, you know, my dad had these clippings in his scrapbooks, and then I found a lot of others. And, you know, for example, his first job in show business was, he worked for a hypnotist, and his job was that he was sort of the shill from the audience who would come up and, at every show, and he would have rocks broken on his chest, because the idea was the hypnotist would put him into this deep slumber, and then he would suspend in between two chairs, and he was supposed to be, you know, so deeply hypnotized that he wouldn't even feel it when a rock was placed on his chest, and then, you know, some guy from the audience who was like the strong guy in the audience would come up and, you know, with a anvil or a hammer or whatever, break this rock. And so my dad used to tell this story, and he would say, oh, you know, it's no big deal, because if your body sort of gives, you know, if you're suspended between the chairs, then you can sort of handle this, and it's not really going to hurt you. Anyway, I started doing all this research on hypnotism in that era, and it turns out there was this kind of big hypnotism craze in the teens, where there were a lot of traveling hypnotists. There was a lot of worry about hypnotists, how they were, there was some headline I came across about, you know, an army of itinerant Bengalis, you know, roaming the nation. The idea that they would sort of lure young men and women away from small towns, and I think partly it was because a lot of them young men and women were leaving small towns and going to the big city and so on, and there was worry about that, and so somehow this, a lot of it was projected onto the idea of these visiting entertainers who would inveigle people away. And so I, you know, I did find a lot about that, actually, and including this particular trick, which it turned out actually was not so, you know, such a lighthearted matter as my father made it seem, because people actually died having it done to them. But anyway, so I, you know, I was able to find, in a way, more than I guess I would have thought. And, you know, I sort of went back and, you know, would try to find the context for these stories that my dad told, that I generally, you know, found kind of what he was talking about and then some.
No, it's interesting. You know, it's got to be, it's great to have the, you know, that window onto that period. I guess I would also wonder about, you know, how he felt. You know, I've thought about that with lots of people who grew up in the 20th century, you know, the change, the rate of change being so great, the amount of upheaval they saw, you know, from World War One through Prohibition and the Roaring 20s, the Depression, and then World War II, and then the nuclear era, you know, in the Cold War. I mean, the amazing amount of political, cultural, and world upheaval that they lived through and witnessed. And for someone like your father, you know, he crossed over all of that as an adult. He was able, right, to, you know, to live long enough to be alive into the end of the 1990s. So he, I mean, his reference, frame of reference, it was pretty incredible, for as would it be for anybody born, you know, 1901 or 1902 and living that long. But it's just, and it's interesting that he also would be able to talk about the difference firsthand about what it's like to be in a proscenium a theater, projecting with just voice, no assistance whatsoever, just your voice, to reach people in a live stage, in a live audience. Then he's involved in film, which is, you know, a mediation of that experience. And then he's involved in television, where you can project across the entire planet, if you will, from a studio anywhere, essentially. I mean, that's an incredible change in the way culture is transmitted that he was part of. And it would have been just really interesting to know what he thought about how those things felt.
Right. And you know, you started off saying so and summing it up so well, how much change, you know, technological and cultural change the 20th century, you know, underwent. And sometimes we think about, you know, what we're living through now and how the internet, for example, has taken over the world so quickly. And yet, even so, when you think about, like, a world that started in the beginning of the 20th century with no, you know, radio, for example, and then had radio, and, you know, the very beginning of cars, and the very beginning of motion pictures, telephone. So I think, actually, there was more change, you know, setting aside world wars and, you know, the emancipation of women and so on. So I think, yes, the 20th century was incredibly you know, full of change and transition. And when you were mentioning all of these very eloquently, all of these, you know, periods of entertainment technology that my father lived through, and I think that, like, at the very end of his life, he died in 1996, and my brother, both my brothers are, well, one's a filmmaker and one's a journalist who founded Salon.com, David Talbot, and so he was just starting that at that time. My father was, you know, still alive, and so he was sort of, I remember him explaining to my father, you know, kind of the internet and how this was going to be a magazine on the internet, you know, and so, you know, my father kind of lived to hear about that, although not really to see the flowering of it. So yeah, and you know, I think some people are like this. I don't think my father, he wasn't really a steeped in nostalgia kind of person. I mean, I'm probably more nostalgic than he was, and I'm probably more nostalgic for his life than he was for his own life. I mean, he kind of went with it, you know, with what was, you know, with the cultural paradigm of the moment, you know. So he adapted to TV very well. He, you know, continued to love to go out and see movies, whatever was contemporary and interesting, until the very end. So he was not a person who lived in the past. You know, this book probably lives in the past more than he did. He liked to tell stories about his glory days, and they were often very funny, but he also would tell stories kind of about that made fun of people's resistance to technology or misunderstanding, like, you know, the famous stories about how you know, people would say, oh, no one will ever go to sound pictures, you know, including, you know, one of the Warner Brothers who was very dubious that sound would ever, you know, the talkies right. would ever take.
Well,
off.
What I think actually the title of your book, The Entertainer, is a really good description of him in just that way, that he was someone who wouldn't look back. He would be always looking out to see, you know, what can I do? What is going to be the thing that's going to carry me forward? Like, I think a lot, and I do think a lot of entertainers in Hollywood have done that, that, you know, the some of his contemporaries who started with vaudeville and ended up, you know, in movies, they were just that way. They weren't nostalgic for the past. They might have been, but they recognized that the future is always where you are. And
that's right.
You know, the kind of tension between the present and the future is where all the action is. So looking backward doesn't really get you anywhere if you want to entertain people.
That's right. And it's sort of the idea that people are the same in the sense that they will always want to be entertained. The medium may be different, you know, the medium will be different, and you have to adapt to whatever the medium is at the moment. But, you know, the fundamental idea, just like the fundamental idea with books, whatever form books take, you know, people are always going to want stories. They're always going to crave storytelling. And entertainment, it's the same way, and probably people, you know, people who can go with that sentiment, like my father, are going to be, you know, happier in the long run than some of us who are maybe a little more, you know, prone to nostalgia and introspection.
I think that's a perfect description. I really have really enjoyed talking to you today about your book and your father and your, you know, the stories that you have to tell. So thanks for doing this.
Great, thank you.
This has been Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm David Wilk. I've been talking to Margaret Talbot about The Entertainer, Movies, Magic, and My Father's 20th Century, which will be out in paperback soon.